Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this breakfast briefing. It's one of a series, as you probably know, that Greens List puts on in the course of a year, in which the focus is on one particular discipline within the law. And this morning's topic, all the topics within the general purview of IP law. We've assembled a group of experienced members of the list who practice in this area regularly, and they're the ones who are going to be providing you with the briefing. They've divided the work up into three broad areas. The first of them is the pre-issue processes, and they'll be looking at that from both sides, the issuing of proceedings, and then the conduct of IP trials. The process that we'll, or the program that we'll follow this morning, will involve the first two presentations, about a quarter of an hour each. We'll then have another break. They'll have freshened up the coffee outside, and we'll be able to go out and have some more caffeine or sustenance of other types. And then after about a quarter of an hour, we'll come back in, have the final presentation, and then we'll have some questions and answers, and aiming to be finished by about 5 to 9. So we can all get on with our daily routine. The three speakers who are going to make the presentations this morning, as I've said, are all experienced IP practitioners. David Sanders has an extensive technology and business background. He's got degrees in both computer science and the law, and before entering the legal profession, he was in fact the managing director of a strategic and information technology consulting business. So he's seen it from both sides. He'd also, along the way to joining the bar, was a judge's associate, and since joining the bar he's maintained an interest in the area through various organisations, including the Law Institute of Victoria's Business Law Committee, the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators, an expert IT panel, and he's a nationally accredited mediator. Gautam Mukherjee is a practitioner broadly across areas of commercial practice, and has a particular interest in intellectual property law. And before coming to the bar, he was a senior associate at Middleton's. I always, as I said a minute ago to some people I was talking to outside, have some real trouble keeping up with the change of names of firms these days. It seems that all the ones you've grown up with have suddenly disappeared or merged, but anyway, it's now K&L Gates. He's had a good deal of experience in advising and acting for both Australian and international clients in a range of matters associated with the protection and enforcement of intellectual property and more general commercial matters, and he's currently completing a Master of Laws at the University of Melbourne. Our third speaker this morning will be Alan Nash. He also has a broad commercial practice, but with a particular interest in intellectual property issues, and he's been involved in a number of major cases in this area. The Biota case involving the drug Relenza was one of the standout ones that I'm sure most of us will immediately recognise. He is a member of the Intellectual Property Society of Australia and New Zealand and a regular contributor to IP Forum, a quarterly intellectual property journal. Before he came to the bar, he was a senior associate at Blake Dawson Waldron, now Blake Dawson. He worked in their intellectual property and IT and telecommunications department. And in that capacity, he's acted as advisor to various state government projects, and disputes arising between governments and other parties in relation to intellectual property. I think that's more than enough to establish the credentials and the experience of the presenters you're going to hear this morning. As I've said, they've divided the program up so that we'll be able to work our way through a conduct of intellectual property proceedings from the time they start with somebody walking in the door of your office through to the time when hopefully you walk out of court if you have to go there with a good judgment in your hands. So we'll hand over to the first presenter, Gautam.
So given the time available, I was proposing only really to cover two matters in a little bit of detail, and they're matters which should be kept in mind when dealing with a client who's come in who's saying that there's potential for their copyright rights to have been infringed, and what they should do about that. It's not in any way to imply that these are the only two matters that you should be focusing on, but they're critically important matters which sort of shape the way that the proceeding should be followed, if it is to be. The first matter I wanted to deal with was properly identifying the work. So this is it's of critical importance to try to fix upon what is trying to be protected and how you seek to protect that and how it falls into the structure of the Act. And that also necessarily deals in part with considering what is the infringement, what you have to look at to define what is being taken from your client. And again, there's concepts within both of those which are interrelated but then considered separately depending on the stage you're at. So at the subsistence stage, which is defining the work, you might be looking at concepts of originality in one way, and then at the infringement stage you'll be looking at it in another way. I'll look at originality only at that first stage only because of the shortness of time. And then finally, I just wanted to go through some very basic practical matters in terms of evidence that you should have a look at. Yes? Oh, isn't it? Maybe I will go up there then.
Is that better? Yeah, that is better. Okay, great. All right, so the final part will be just essentially dealing with some practical, the evidence you should be collecting and defining ownership, which is also something which can lead to some problems. So the first step in every case, regardless of whether it's IP related or otherwise, is identifying what your client wants to achieve and how you might be able to do this for your client. In the copyright context, this will involve identifying the work that your client is seeking to protect. And this becomes important because of the nature of copyright rights. As you're all aware, there's no registration system in Australia. Copyright exists from the moment of creation of the work. That said, copyright is a right which doesn't exist in any way other than as provided by the Copyright Act. And that's explicitly stated in Section 8. So what the implication of that is, or what that means in practical terms, is there are no common law rights to copyright. So the rights you find are all set out in the Act, which makes it easier in a way. And secondly, and most importantly, your client, in seeking to enforce their rights, must show that the work that they're seeking to protect is described in the Act. Anything not described in the Act is not going to be capable of copyright protection. So then you look at what is capable of being protected, and Section 32 tells you the types of work in which copyright subsist, and they are an original, literary, dramatic, musical and artistic work. There's also additional subject matter in which copyright can subsist, and these are in Sections 89 to 92, sound recordings, cinematograph films, television broadcasts and sound broadcasts, and published editions of work. So the first question which then arises from looking at the work is, well, what is an original work? And in the copyright context, the key thing to remember is originality is not like the patents context. There's no requirement for an inventive step, and there's no creative judgment involved at the stage of subsistence. All you're looking at is it an original creation of the author? The question of originality is different at the stage of infringement, when you're looking at infringement. And again, I just flagged that that's something you should be aware of, but I can't really, there's probably not enough time to go into it today. Then the next thing to look at will be, does the work that your client is seeking to protect fall into one of those categories, for example, set out in section 32? And the important thing to note here is that while some of those categories are defined as indicative, so they show literary works include a table or a compilation, etc., dramatic works include certain types of work, but an artistic work is defined exhaustively, or rather it's defined in a confined way, because it says artistic work means, and then it says a painting, sculpture, drawing, engraving, and each of those terms are more definitely enumerated. And then there's photographs, a building or model of a building. So the key is, if you're looking to protect an artistic work, is to make sure that the work you're seeking to protect falls into one of those categories, and you can describe it as one of those categories. So in determining whether the work or subject matter sought to be protected is described in the act or not, it's sometimes helpful to approach the analysis based on an understanding of what the Copyright Act won't protect, or what copyright won't protect, and which is, it protects an expression of an idea, but it doesn't protect the idea itself, which is again making this distinction between patents and copyright. And the idea expression dichotomy sort of, it like everything, it becomes more complicated as you get to the peripheries of that dichotomy. So it's pretty clear that the concept of a TV show, the idea for a TV show, is not going to be protected. The plot idea for an unwritten book is not going to be protected unless the book has been written. And in some circumstances, if someone's taken the basic structure of the book, and there's the case involving Jaws, which is a Coppola production case, where the court found that taking the sinews of the work, so taking the specific plot points within the work, could be considered copyright infringement. The question becomes vexed when you look at things which sort of fall into that grey area of an idea and an expression. It's probably best demonstrated when you consider computer programs. So on one side, you've got, if someone's seeking to protect a computer program, it can be copied through the copying of the code itself, and that's clearly copyright infringement, in that computer program is recognised as a literary work, and if someone's taken the code, then there's copyright infringement. However, it is possible that someone, and this has been before the court, it is possible for a computer programmer to have taken the code that your client has come up with, used another language to achieve the same ends, and then create a program which in the code itself is totally different. It's clearly copied and obtaining and providing the same functions as your client's program. But then what really are you seeking to protect? Are you seeking to protect the idea, the function of your computer program, and is that something protectable under copyright? Now, it becomes a bit more difficult there, because potentially that's just an idea that's being protected. I don't propose to give you a solution to that. It's probably something that you need to consider on the facts, and having a look through to see whether there is some way to argue that it's more than just the idea which you're seeking to protect, and it's the expression. again, something that can aid that analysis of, well, is it an idea or an expression that my client is trying to protect, is going to be looking at what is it that they say has been infringed, or what has the infringer, the purported infringer done? What are they said to have copied? Is it the look of the thing? Is it the idea behind it? And this will often also help you identify the scope of the work that you're looking at. So if for example, it's a text, then and is it the whole of the text which has been copied, or is it alleged that only part of a chapter has been copied, or is it a picture within the book which has been copied? And then that way, that can help you define more precisely what it is that you're seeking to protect and what that work is. The test for determining whether there has been an infringement is whether there's a substantial part taken. And the one thing that the courts are clear on is that there is no formula to be applied in determining whether a substantial part has been taken. There's no 10% rule, you change so much and you won't be infringing, or alternatively, they've only taken so much and therefore they can't be seen to be infringing. That's simply not the case. And in ICE TV, said the word substantial has been said to be not only susceptible of ambiguity, but to be a word calculated to conceal a lack of precision. The various possible shades of meaning the word bears will be determined by the context. And further, what is substantial, and this is in Designers Guild, beg your pardon, what is substantial in a particular case is a question of fact to be determined having regard to all the circumstances. And in the case of Designers Guild Limited and Russell Williams said the question of substantiality is one of mixed law and fact, in the sense that it requires the judge to apply a legal standard to the facts as found. Bearing this in mind, it's not possible to set out a general rule, and if a client comes to you asking for that general rule, that's essentially the answer, that it's not possible, and that's why they need you. And essentially you would have to be looking at the type of work it is, because that will determine what the substantial part is, potentially, and then what has been taken. The final point that I wanted to cover was the ownership and some of these practical issues that should be covered off. Once you've established that there is a work, that there's been an infringement of some sort, or that you think that there's a legitimate argument to be made that something has been taken from your client, you need to establish and make sure that your client actually owns the copyright in the work that they claim as their own. Oftentimes a person will be working from the assumption that they own the copyright or they own rights in the work that they're seeking to protect, but this should be a question that you put to them directly. So did they create it, or did an employee create it, or did someone else create it under contract for them? How did they come to be the owner, as they claim to be, of the work? If they didn't create it, then you really need to understand on what basis they're claiming these rights, because the Act specifically says that you have to have a written assignment of rights. That's in section 196. So in order to have an assignment of copyright rights, it has to be in writing. If there is no assignment, and you establish that there was another party which had created this work, then you should get an assignment done as soon as possible, making sure to assign all the associated rights with that work. There are circumstances under which the court has recognised equitable assignments, so where it's held that a party holds the rights on trust for the person who's litigating, but it's not a situation you want to find yourself in. Another issue, which is probably not as common and quite uncommon, but nonetheless important, is, and in a business context where there's designers from overseas, is to ensure that the place in which the copyright work was created, if it wasn't Australia, falls under one of the convention countries. So the protection can actually be continued on into Australia. Bedding down the issue of ownership is very important for two reasons, amongst many others, no doubt. Firstly, if you don't have an assignment, then before litigation is commenced, then this will affect your rights, even if you complete an assignment after litigation has been commenced. This may affect your rights in relation to recovery of damages, in terms of what you can sue in relation to. And secondly, and perhaps most importantly, is Section 202 of the Act, which says that shouldn't be making groundless threats of copyright infringement, and which would essentially give rise to a cause of action for the person that you're writing a letter of demand to sue your client for making groundless threats. Threatening proceedings without actually holding the copyright or an exclusive license will in most circumstances be considered to be a groundless threat. Now, there's obviously other elements to it in terms of the damage caused, which would justify that proceeding, but it losing the focus of the litigation at that very early stage from what you're seeking to protect for your client and shifting that to potentially something that your client has done incorrectly.
Quick question, exact issue come up yesterday, and one of the issues is a general assignment of copyright, but there's no specific wording providing the right to sue for past infringements. And do you know, is there any law around that, whether the assignment has to specifically go there, or if it's just a general assignment, you know, like a single clause in a standard form of agreement?
The rights in relation to past and future should be specifically covered off. If they're not, then there's going to be a problem. And the final point I wanted to make in the time available was in relation to records. And again, this is something which is obviously clear across all areas of the law, but especially in intellectual property matters, where oftentimes infringement or issues which are being raised are things which you're finding on the internet. Good idea to, if the client is saying, I've seen my work being produced here on the internet, then get a screen capture of it. Make sure that you have a copy of that. Make sure you have some kind of record of where it was, when it was, the date it was, what it looked like, in order to ensure that you can maintain that chain of evidence when it comes to any kind of litigation. Unless there's any questions at that stage, I might sit down and hand over to David. Yes.
Do you need a written assignment for employees?
No. So it'll be in your employment contract, which you'd be dealing with it, and there'd be, it's not.
No.
Okay. There's a presumption. There's a presumption in the Act in relation to.
How do you deal with identifying authors then, where you've got multiple people working on effectively a joint project, and you all of them are employees or owners?
Yeah. The court. So initially there was this idea. Only recently there was an idea that you would need to identify a specific author, but that's not the case. It's essentially you need to identify that there was a author. The debate now seems to be about whether there's a consideration of whether it's mechanically produced, whether there's a work which has been mechanically produced or produced by a human, because you need to have a human author. But to specifically identify this person doesn't seem to be necessary.
Thank you.
Any other questions at this stage?
That being said, it's always a good idea to be able to identify all the authors.
Sure.
If it ever comes to that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gavin. I think David's next.
I just want to do a whistle-stop tour of some of the matters that can be considered after the identification initial instructions analysis had been done, as Gautam has just been speaking to you about, before you issued. So this is from the perspective of an applicant. I'll disclose now, I'm not going to be talking really about the law very much at all. It's going to be more pointers to the law. I expect you'll have a paper in your email which will give you some of the authorities and so on, a bit more substance than what I can cover in the time that's available. I should also say that my background is inherently technology, so you'll see that a lot of what I'm talking about is very much skewed towards today's digital economy and the matters around that. So I'm briefly touched on preliminary applications that can be made, consideration of other causes of action, and where experts can be consulted and where they're potentially useful, and touching on jurisdiction. All jurisdictions have abilities to perform preliminary discovery of broadly two different classes. So if you have a situation where the client knows the identity of someone who may have infringed, and there may be a cause of action, but has insufficient information to make that decision about whether they should issue, then preliminary discovery is available. In copyright, it's particularly useful to look at two questions. One is to examine, is there some substance to actual infringing conduct, the causal nexus between what I know I have as a client and what it seems that they've created or produced or copied or reproduced or whatever the infringing behaviour is. There's also the simple practical matter of information regarding possible quantum. It might be that there has been an infringement, but is it actually worth issuing? And now that is not a question of are they judgment proof, in terms of do they hold assets, but if the remedy that you'd be seeking is a count of profits, then knowledge about did they sell commercially, are there any profits up front, will stop wasting the time of the court and your client. Analysing the recent cases on this, the most common mistakes in making an application like that is to either misunderstand or misconceive the purpose of it. It is only to make that decision. It is not to decide the case. And to not be in a position of being able to say that reasonable inquiries have already been made. This is not an excuse for not doing your job. So you have to get to a point of impasse before making the application. Examples of this, I'll give you citations later, include orders against former employees to identify computers that were connected to the employment network at a particular time, so therefore may have been involved in infringing conduct, or accounting records, or documents that relate to access of various documents or reverse engineering or internal processes that would show that chain. Another form of preliminary discovery allows the circumstance of the cause of action is known, but the identity of the infringer is not. So an infringing work has been discovered, something is known about it, perhaps where it is, but not the identity of the infringer. So preliminary discovery can also be used in that case to compel the discovery of information about the identity. Most common mistakes here are not be able to satisfy the court that the cause of action is actually known sufficiently so that there is an intention to proceed once the identity is known. Examples of that include identifying a manufacturer or a supplier to someone who is then distributing infringing material. Anton Piller orders also have their place in this jurisdiction. They're well discussed in many contexts, but in particular, of course, they concern the preservation of evidence. And as the infringing works or alleged infringing works themselves or documents about processes that were used to create them are evidence, then they're potentially the subject matter of these. They have the advantage over preliminary discovery in that Anton Piller orders will authorise entry to physical premises and search and seizure. So common orders would be to seize computers, take copies of records, to allow forensic analysis to be done from those. The usual injunctions are of course available. Urgent injunctions are particularly useful if the material that you're concerned or your client is concerned about being distributed is sensitive in some way, and so the harm that would arise from the further communication of the infringing material could not be compensated by an award of damages. And if that's the case, then injunctions are available. Quite often, the case with copyright infringements or matters where your client is aware of infringing conduct or possible infringing conduct, there are other courses of action that are available to them. They should always be considered. If there is an existing relationship between the client and an alleged infringer, then consider all of the other things besides copyright, because the copyright action might fail, particularly if there are problems with identification of substantial part or objective similarity, or if the respondent is said to be an innocent infringer. Under the provisions of the Act, an innocent infringer cannot be the subject of an award of damages, only an account of profits. The other actions that are worth considering and should be considered in most cases: breach of contract. This is particularly the case if there's a commercial relationship or a relationship of employment between the applicant and the prospective respondent. Breaches of fiduciary duty or confidence. If the person said to be infringing was an entrusted employee, had a commercial relationship, a fiduciary relationship such as a director or a party, then there may be breaches of those duties. Estoppel, particularly useful if there's no contract, but various representations have been made. Misleading and deceptive conduct is the old Section 52 or Section 1819 of the Consumer Law. And trademarks and passing off. Situations where, say, marketing material, training material, internal processes, internal policies are involved, then there is often the possibility there's also been some misrepresentation or passing off that is called deceptive similarity and gives rise to other actions. Extreme examples of that include Microsoft and the PC Club, where software was being pre-installed on computers and fake certificates of authenticity were being provided. Doesn't get much more blatant than that. And in that particular case, misleading deceptive conduct was also available and gave remedies along with trademark violation. A recent case, federal court case of Volunteer Echo students, showed an example of where a former employee becomes a director of a rival company and then makes various statements on the web passes themselves off as having experience that they don't have, uses photographs, uses marketing material of the company, the applicant in that case, and acts against their interest. Copyright, breach of employment, contract, breach of confidence are all actions available in that case, particularly when a website uses the photographs from the former employer or makes representations about status and information from that and ownership. I want to briefly consider the use of experts within these matters. Expert evidence is particularly important in copyright matters when one is examining either the processes of how the infringement is said to have occurred, what reproduction, what copying was involved, so the causal connection, or the question of was it a substantial part. The law in this is very, very difficult. Where it's not blatant. Gotham has referred to ITV. There are a number of cases, a number of difficulties that arise with substantial part, and it does require opinion, and therefore experts. So those two broad areas. An example, it's outside of my normal experience. The question of sufficient degree of objective similarity on architectural plans. A breach of copyright can include a three-dimensional adaptation of a two-dimensional plan. So a building can infringe. Now that will probably not be a surprise to most of you. It might be a big surprise to some of you. So the question then becomes, how do we prove that this building infringes on the plans? And the answer is experts come in and the experts examine things like relative position of rooms, layouts, different scopes of drawings, finishes that are involved, and other areas. Which, interestingly enough, verge on functionality, verge on that idea that is not protected, but nonetheless it's all about the material form. I'll give you a citation on that. In computer software, similar problems arise. There are a number of cases where experts have been used to look at that difficulty of, in gaming cases, the feel, the rhythm, algorithms, statistical characteristics. They sound like ideas, but because they have a material form, and they are something that comes into substance, something on the screen that can be seen, they can be subject of expert evidence from there. Experts can also be used to say when an infringement has occurred or how great the infringement is, what the extent of the copying is, or physical characteristics of a manufacture process. I will just finish with two last questions. The first one, what jurisdiction, if the decision to issue is made, should be taken? The two key jurisdictions for many of these matters are the Federal Court and the Federal Circuit Court. The Federal Court, I think, it could be said is the natural home of complex copyright matters. The leading cases largely come from that jurisdiction, and certainly if the matter is large or complex, that's a natural place. The Federal Circuit Court has a commercial panel with IP experience. They're faster to get on, generally cheaper to some extent. But there is also a risk because of the way their costs formula works. Unless otherwise ordered, it's lump sum costs, which often don't reflect the real position. Also mentioned that there is a intellectual property list in the Victorian Supreme Court, and if the copyright is secondary to other matters, there are other lists that have no problem determining these matters. All of those factors should be considered. The last question is it worth issuing? This question is no different for a copyright matter than any other piece of litigation. It's a question of commercial risk, litigation risk, identification of what is the harm, what is the risk of the harm if it's allowed to continue, what is the remedy, will the remedy be effective, how much will it cost, what are the prospects anyway, if I obtain remedy, of it actually working. It's particularly a problem in technology matters with jurisdiction, servers that live in a non-convention country. I think I'll leave it at that point. You'll see a paper in a week or so with authorities behind that. I hope that's given just a couple of things to think about before issuing and other options that are available.
Thank you.